and telling the fact that no one is excluded. All the people will hear the call.
Right.
The other phrase mentioned in the narration is that أَهْلُ الْأَرْضِ, all the people, or جَمِيعُ أَهْلِ الْأَرْضِ, all the inhabitants of the earth will hear the heavenly call.
Right.
فَيُؤْمِنُ أَهْلُ الْأَرْضِ إِذَا سَمِعُوا الصَّوْتَ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ. The Imam says, the people of the earth, all the inhabitants on the planet earth, they will believe Imam Mahdi alayhi salam when they hear the voice from the heaven.
Heaven.
Or يَسْمَعُهُ جَمِيعُ أَهْلِ الْأَرْضِ, all the people of the earth will hear it. And the other narration reads, يُعْلِنُ بِاسْمِهِ, the heavenly call mentions the name of the Imam, وَيَسْمَعُهُ كُلُّ خَالْقِ, all the people will hear the voice. Third group of narrations refer to the fact that not only the people, but rather all the creatures will hear the voice.
Nice.
And this is also interesting, which can be a miracle. We have only one narration regarding this, of course. The Imam says, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, as quoted by Abu Basir, there is no creature created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala which has a soul, including the animals, that all of them will hear the heavenly cry. Al-Ghiba by Nu'man.
All right, so it's not just human beings. It's
according to this one narration,
all the
it's
creatures.
Not only human beings. Okay. All creatures, at least those with a soul,
right?
Even animal soul, they will hear the heavenly call.
Cry.
And this is not, very far based on the Islamic teachings that وَإِن مِّن شَيْءٍ إِلَّا يُسَبِّحُ بِحَمْدِهِ, that every creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala glorifies Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala
indeed.
In one way or another.
Indeed.
The next point mentioned in the narrations is that, as I mentioned, the heavenly call is not specific to one group of people. And this was the question of Zurara, who asked Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and the Imam says that it is inclusive. All the people will hear it. Every nation, every people will hear the voice in their own language. It's not necessarily through the technology that we are familiar with. It can be through a miracle, that this is a heavenly call, that every person, every nation hears that call with his or her own language.
Right.
The narration is quoted in Kamaluddin, volume 2, page 556.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for that information. And we'll, inshallah, discuss more with you in the upcoming sessions. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Midstream.
On the 27th of December 2008, the Israeli occupation began one of its many military aggressions against the Gaza Strip with an operation called Cast Lead, while the Palestinian resistance chose to call it the Battle of Al-Furqan, and it lasted about 23 days, ending on January 19, 2009, now known as the Day of Gaza. The Islamic Republic of Iran commemorates the Day of Gaza every year as the symbol of resistance of Palestinians against the Zionist regime. This year, the Day of Gaza will have a very special impact given the genocide Gaza is still currently living through as Zionist Israel gets away with terrorism and aggression yet again. The 2008-2009 war resulted back then in at least 1,500 martyrs, including 300 children, and massive destruction of Gaza's infrastructure. Many Palestinian civilians were killed in attacks by high-precision weapons, which were capable of pinpoint strikes and can hit within a meter of their targets, and which have exceptionally good optics, allowing those carrying out or directing the strikes to see the targets in detail. Hence, as anticipated, Zionist Israel deliberately targeted civilians. Despite its end and the passage of years, the Israeli entity leaders were never held accountable and punished for their crimes against the Gaza Strip and its residents, despite international and human rights organizations acknowledging in their reports the occurrence of war crimes against civilians. Which is why, ladies and gents, Zionist Israel opted to continue its genocide against Gaza again in 2012, Pillar of Defense War, named Shale Stones by the Resistance. Then in 2014, Protective Edge War, named Consumed Storm by the Resistance. Then in 2018 and 2019, and Saif al-Quds 2021, and the Unified Battlefield 2022, and last but ever, so not least, Al-Aqsa Flood 2023, the largest, most horrifying ongoing genocide ever to be witnessed in the 21st century, in which Zionist Israel has so far killed 23,000 civilians, 7,000 of whom are children. Let us clear the air once and for all. No, it did not start on October 7th. Gaza has been under the most severe siege by Zionist militias over the past two decades, and Tel Aviv, under various pretexts, took anti-human measures, such as cutting off contact with other areas, preventing people from fishing and importing fuel, food, and medicine, or is imposing widespread military aggression against Gazans. Back in 2008, the Zionist regime, which has always been known for break promise and child killing since the establishment of its aggressive regime, launched massive airstrikes on Gaza on December 27 and used 64 fighter jets and military helicopters, and in its first hours, more than 100 tons of missiles and bombs were fired at Gaza. This time, in 2023, during the first 5 days of the Al-Aqsa flood in Gaza, over 1,000 martyrs rose and more than 5,000 were injured. Today, more Palestinians were killed and more properties were destroyed in the 100-day Zionist genocidal war than in any previous Israeli offensive. This makes the Day of Gaza this year a monumental one. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. January 19 marks Gaza Day in Iran, a day in which Iranians voice their support for the resistance of the people of the Gaza Strip against the Israeli entity hostilities. Day of Gaza in Iran commemorates the resistance of the brave Palestinian people during the 22 days of the Zionist regime's aggression on the Gaza Strip in 2008-2009. Now, this year, Gaza Day has a special resonance, given the ongoing genocide in Gaza for 100 days now, taking the lives of at least 23,000 civilians, 7,000 of whom are children under the age of 14. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Saleh Abu Azzeh, Palestinian political commentator. Thanks a million for being with us, Mr. Saleh. Now, as we commemorate Day of Gaza, announced by the Islamic Republic of Iran on January 19, remembering the massacres committed by the Zionist entity back in 2009, we witness today the genocide of the century like no other. Right there, in the same space in Gaza, as we enter, we surpassed 100 days of the Zionist aggression already. It's a psychotic war of genocide against the Palestinian people. But how does remembering massacres that happened in 2009 to what is happening today, I mean, what we witness today is a complete genocidal act. How does remembering the past help?
There is no doubt that the acts of genocide committed by the Israeli occupation against the Palestinian people have not ceased since 1948. Every year witnesses a series of massacres perpetrated by Israeli forces, settlers, and gangs against the Palestinian people. 2009 specifically marked the first assault on Gaza, starting at the end of 2008 and extending into the beginning of 2009. This attack followed the liberation of Gaza in 2005 and was one of the most brutal assaults witnessed in the post-liberation period. The occupation did not stop at the 2008-2009 assault. It continued throughout the previous 15 years with attacks occurring nearly every year or every 2 years, demonstrating brutal aggression against Gaza. Without a doubt, remembering 2009, we face a significant increase in Palestinian casualties at the hands of the Zionist American death machine. Perhaps the main difference, in addition to the increased casualties compared to 2009, is that the attacks in 2009, 2012, and 2014 had Israeli entity origins overall. As for the year 2023-2024, this prolonged aggression, lasting for more than 100 days, is a Zionist American-British assault. This implies that Zionist Israel acts as an executive tool for the United States and to some extent for the Arabs receiving support in various forms, especially considering that the missiles and projectiles launched at Gaza are predominantly American, British, and European.
Well, Mr. Saleh, after the 2009 war, just like you said, Gaza suffered more Zionist wars in 2012, in 2014, 18, 19, 21 with Saif al-Quds, and 22, and now 23, 24 as well. However, Gaza remains steadfast. The resistance proves day after day that it is still strong and it does still have the upper hand in the field in Gaza. But 23,000 human losses, that's not counting those still under the rubble. How is that resilience still effective inside of Gaza?
We must remember the numbers well. We witnessed 100,000 victims in the Gaza Strip, including martyrs, missing persons, and the wounded. When we talk about 100 days, it means we are talking about 1,000 victims daily at the hands of the Israeli entity death machine against the Palestinian people. This is sufficient evidence that Zionist Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinian people. The resilience of the resistance and the Palestinian people can be attributed to several factors. Firstly, the Palestinian people's faith in their cause, the justice of this issue, and the belief that a price must be paid for the liberation of the land, people, and Palestinian sanctities. Secondly, we cannot ignore the support standing beside the Palestinian people, whether from the Islamic Republic or the resistance axis in general. In this war, we observe the diplomatic, political, military, and security efforts unified in support of the Palestinian cause by the resistance axis led by the Islamic Republic of Iran. We witness the actions of the Islamic resistance in Iraq and the Northern Front ignited by Hezbollah the following day. We also saw the significant role played by the armed forces in Yemen, supported by overwhelming popular support from all segments of the Yemeni people. All of this undoubtedly strengthens the steadfastness of the Palestinian people, the conviction of the Palestinian that the catastrophe in 1948 and the defeat in 1967 will not be repeated and that they will remain resilient on this land regardless of the cost, increases the cost of steadfastness to prevent displacement. In a final note, there is a significant alignment between Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people. The majority overwhelmingly support the actions of the Palestinian resistance, considering themselves a nurturing environment for this resistance. They must persevere until the resistance withstands aggression and fulfills its duties against Zionist Israeli attacks on the Palestinian people.
Well, it gets us to the support that the Palestinian people should get and are getting from certain friends like the Islamic Republic of Iran, who intentionally named January 19 the Day of Gaza because of its unconditional support to all the resistance in the region and specifically the Palestinian resistance itself. Despite the fact that it is being named by the Western media and the Zionist entity that Iran is behind the October 7 attacks, Iran is behind the closure of the Red Sea in front of the shipments or the ships, the Zionist ships, or any shipments going to the Zionist entity. What help does commemorating past massacres do in such cases?
Firstly, there is no doubt that there are clear stances from the Islamic Republic of Iran, represented by Supreme Leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in addition to the Iranian leadership and the Iranian people's popular stance. Thus, the Islamic Republic always stands by the Palestinian cause and supports it on all levels. But should any state be truly blamed for standing by the victim, or should the blame fall on those siding with the oppressor, the killer, and the criminal committing genocide? October 7th was a genuine Palestinian reaction to all the massacres and genocide committed by Zionist Israel against the Palestinian people. The Islamic Republic of Iran should be thanked by Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, and even nations worldwide for adopting an ethical, humane, and national stance by standing with the oppressed and the vulnerable. However, blame should be placed on those standing with Zionist Israel, which is currently committing genocide. This underscores the credibility of the Islamic Republic of Iran's position. Since Zionist Israel and not the Palestinians are being prosecuted in the International Court of Justice, the Palestinian people are the victims in this equation. South Africa is globally praised, as is Iran and anyone standing on the side of truth for the Palestinians. By the way, according to international laws, Gaza, the occupied West Bank, and Al-Quds are considered territories occupied by Zionist Israel. International law guarantees the right of peoples to self-determination and the right of peoples to snatch liberation from the fangs of any occupation. Now Iran, South Africa, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen stand on the side of those resisting occupation. Blame should be placed on the United States, Britain, and Germany, which support genocide and support Zionist Israel with its killing machinery. Certainly, what the Islamic Republic is doing is a commendable effort from free nations, and it should be a blessed and internationally adopted stance. All peoples and all nations should stand by the just Palestinian cause.
Definitely. Mr. Saleh Abu Izzi, Palestinian political commentator, thanks a million for joining us to talk about the Day of Gaza, which will be held on January 19, especially in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Thank you very much for being with us. Stay tuned, ladies and gents, because we will be talking about the escalation of the United States and Britain on the free and sovereign Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The U.S. attempt to persuade the Yemenis to allow Israeli entity ships to recross through the Red Sea Strait appears to be one of the most prominent immediate challenges facing the United States of America, which many in this world classify as a superpower. Today, the United States is shocked by the free Yemen and its resilient people, and this is what makes its incitement threats and blatant and illegal military aggression absolutely useless, no matter the advanced weapon it chooses to use. More details in the following report.
The U.S.-British aggression on several Yemeni provinces under the control of the Sana'a government last week failed to achieve any military objectives, turning into a blatant assault on Yemeni sovereignty. These attacks no doubt will have military repercussions that may extend to American bases in the region. Sana'a will be pushed to escalate to the third stage in the Red Sea, where the Yemeni armed forces have set their goals to close the sea to commercial ships belonging to countries attacking Yemen's territories and national sovereignty. Sana'a was aware of the aggression last Friday, according to informed sources, expecting it to happen about a week ago. However, Washington and London waited for the UN Security Council's decision, which US media reported, citing diplomats, that the United States modified its wording to overcome Chinese objections. Then both the US and the UK were surprised by the large-scale attack launched by Yemeni forces last Tuesday, considering it an unprecedented insult instead of naming it as it is, a retaliation to the targeting of the Yemeni naval forces, which led to the martyrdom of 10 Yemeni soldiers the week before the last. The U.S. then resorted to a military aggression, utilizing all their media means to propagate misleading information that Yemen is targeting international navigation and trade in the Red Sea. Rather than merely ships heading to occupied Palestine in solidarity with Gaza to ensure the genocide stops and much-needed food and aid reaches Gaza. Hours before the execution of the aggression operation, Washington and London addressed their statements to the American and British publics before addressing the Yemenis, whom they did not urge to exercise caution, ignoring the fact that this people had withstood 270,000 airstrikes without yielding to the Saudi Emirati aggression, acting as proxies for the United States and Britain. Contrary to the expectations of the latter after the operation, which the U.S. Central Command stated was carried out using advanced weapons through about 100 air and missile strikes on several Yemeni provinces, some of which involved Tomahawk missiles launched by submarines, the aggression concluded without achieving any objectives. This marks the first declared military aggression operation by major powers against Yemen, ending in failure and opening the door wide for the Yemeni armed forces to respond forcefully and painfully in the coming days and weeks. It is noteworthy that Sana'a's naval forces initiated a primary response just 7 minutes after the strikes, launching a missile attack on U.S. warships in the Red Sea. Following massive popular protests on the same day, with the participation of millions of Yemenis in response to the aggression, the Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces in the Sana'a government, Mahdi al-Mashat, who serves as the head of the Supreme Political Council, affirmed in a statement reported by official media that the unjustified American Zionist British aggression on Yemen is a violation of all laws, and the countries participating in it will pay a high price.
Now to discuss this issue with us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, Mr. Talib al-Hassani, political commentator. It's a pleasure to have you with us, Mr. Talib. Now, Sana'a has been anticipating a comprehensive Western war on Yemen since the first attack it launched against Israeli entity navigation in the Red Sea, specifically ships going to the Zionist Israeli entity, since that was very clear back then for the Yemeni leadership that there will be some sort of retaliation by the West. Why did they choose to proceed with this plan of theirs?
Greetings to you. I believe there are three backgrounds for taking this decision. The first background is the religious dimension and religious responsibility, especially given the fatwa from the Association of Yemeni Scholars and before that, the position of Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi. The religious background is a significant factor in many decisions related to domestic affairs and even foreign policy. The second issue is aligning with the axis of resistance within the unity of battlefields in confronting the Israeli Zionist enemy. This commitment cannot be ignored, particularly in the face of a heinous aggression and an unprecedented siege on Gaza. The third issue is the popular will, the popular support, the large and confident popular mobilization and internal national unity standing behind the political and military leadership. There is also military readiness. Even if there were other backgrounds without military readiness and military preparedness, I believe there would have been a different stance. But ultimately, military readiness is the foundation for this Yemeni position.
Mm-hmm. Well, amid the growing reactions, both popular and political, inside of Yemen, and in the media as well, supporting Yemen's closure of navigation against the Israeli entity and rejection of the American and British aggression, obviously, on Yemen. What do you think the upcoming Yemeni approach will be in the event that the foreign aggression continues? Because we did see it continuing over the past days with the cohesion of the Yemeni forces despite their national differences.
I believe that facing off with the United States and how Yemen's response is already predetermined, the nature of Yemen's response was defined as outlined by Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi in response to the threats. The recent military action by the United States and Britain, and possibly its continuation, albeit with reduced intensity, was preceded by clear threats. Therefore, Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi predetermined the nature of the response, stating that any aggression or attacks on Yemen will be met with a direct military response targeting three arenas. The first arena includes American interests in the region, especially in the Red Sea, encompassing various interests. The second arena targets American naval navigation and consequently British navigation, as Britain is a partner in the military aggression against Yemen. This will lead to an expansion of targeting in the Red Sea, including American and British commercial ships passing through this passage. The third arena includes military ships and naval bases on the African side of the Red Sea, which are numerous, ranging from the Djibouti to Eritrea to some islands near Somalia. This is the response arena. This will result in many consequences in the Red Sea, as currently discussed, with shipping companies being uneasy about passing through this area. Consequently, the United States has failed to achieve its declared primary goal, which is protecting Zionist Israeli entity ships. Zionist Israeli ships are now prohibited from passing and will not pass in the future. The second goal is that America aspires to reduce Sana'a's military capabilities, which is not possible and cannot be achieved because Yemen is in a state of war with a fundamentally different military situation. Yemen lacks visible military camps, military bases, or visible weapon depots. All these complexities add challenges for the Americans. Therefore, Yemen's response in this significant arena will strike the interests of the United States and Britain. The escalating effects in the Red Sea region have already begun, with the rising costs of maritime shipping and fuel prices increasing due to the disruption of fuel supplies. Approximately 6 million barrels of oil passing through this region. Even Qatari liquefied gas is affected, as 4 Qatari liquefied gas carriers have halted passing through this area today. Consequently, America has not achieved its objectives, but Yemen in return has achieved many goals, including reducing exports in this region.
Definitely, what you're saying will have a direct military effect on the situation in the region around Yemen, but it also will affect the political scene inside of Yemen. How do you think that will affect the Yemeni-Saudi peace process that has been stalled for the past 2 years, but it is actually there? How will that be affected?
Certainly, both Saudi Arabia and American convictions suggest that the war in Yemen, led by the Saudi coalition, is not progressing in the direction they desire. Halting the war, ceasing military operations, and partially lifting the blockade were primarily in the interest of both the United States and Saudi Arabia. Therefore, the current escalation has not impacted the airspace at Sana'a International Airport or maritime navigation to the ports of Hodeidah. This serves as a gauge for the continuation of negotiations and commitment to a political solution. Ultimately, Yemen will not link the political solution to its duties regarding the Palestinian cause and Gaza. When Yemen made the decision related to Gaza, there was a conviction that if the political solution were affected, it would not be compromised for the sake of the Palestinian cause. In reality, there will be no significant impact, and I believe that the absence of Saudi Arabia from the coalition formed by the United States, at least officially and explicitly, is beneficial for the continuation of the political solution. Even if Saudi Arabia desires to see Yemen defeated in this battle, its absence from the coalition is also favorable for the political solution to persist. Before the aggression, the United States claimed that a political solution in Yemen will be guaranteed, even one better than what Yemen aspires to achieve if it ceases support for Palestine. However, this proposition was categorically rejected within Yemen. Hence, the political solution will continue for reasons related to American interests and the inability to sustain their war against Yemen.
Mr. Talib al-Hassani, political commentator all the way from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, we thank you very much. We support you. We support your cause. We support your people. Victory, inshallah, for Yemen and for Palestine and for the entire resistance axis in our region. I want to thank you very much, ladies and gents. We promise you to give you always the latest updates from the region of West Asia. We'll be seeing you again next week on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight. For decades, the U.S. dollar has been the dominant currency in the global financial system. However, in recent years, a de-dollarization trend has gained momentum as countries try to reduce their exposure to the risks and fluctuations associated with the U.S. dollar. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Russia Today, RT Network, has covered this story and tells us more. According to the latest data released by the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, the U.S. dollar's share of global central bank reserves has continued to decrease, nosediving to 59.2% in the third quarter of 2023. The decline comes amid the de-dollarization trend gaining momentum across the globe. The International Monetary Fund statistics show the greenback's share is down from roughly 70% in 2000. The dollar remains the world's leading reserve currency, with the euro coming in second, while the latter's share has slid to 19.6%. The Japanese yen's proportion of world reserves grew to 5.5% from 5.3% in the previous three-month period. The Chinese yuan, the British pound, the Canadian dollar, and the Swiss franc were little changed. Meanwhile, according to data compiled by Global Financial Messaging Service, SWIFT, the yuan's share of international payments hit a record high in November, with the renminbi becoming the fourth most used currency worldwide. Cross-border yuan lending has risen as well, while the People's Bank of China holds over 30 bilateral currency swaps with foreign central banks, including the central banks of Saudi Arabia and Argentina. According to SWIFT, the growing share of the yuan in cross-border transactions reflects China's trend of shifting away from the U.S. dollar, as well as Beijing's efforts to promote the use of the renminbi. The global trend towards using national currencies in trade instead of the U.S. dollar began to gain momentum last year, after the Ukraine-related sanctions saw Russia cut off from the Western financial system and its foreign reserves frozen. The European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the EBRD, has warned that Russia's growing trade in the Chinese yuan as a response to Western sanctions could potentially erode the strength of the U.S. dollar. Economists have been also indicating that Western trade restrictions have led to an increased usage of the Chinese yuan globally at the expense of the greenback. Iran's Fars News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri-Kani has said in Tehran that, like other BRICS member states, Iran will work on the de-dollarization of trade, economy and financial transactions within the group of major emerging economies, adding that some moves in this direction are already underway. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri-Kani stated, "We have planned many missions and joint works with other BRICS members within the framework of this organization." Bagheri-Kani added, "While the de-dollarization trend has gained momentum across the globe, one of the most important tasks is the de-dollarization of trade and economic transactions and financial transactions." Iranian officials have repeatedly charged the United States with using the dollar as an instrument to wage economic and political war against independent nations. They have touched on the policy to use other currencies in place of the U.S. dollar, stressing the hegemony of the dollar in the global economy is coming to an end. According to reports, the dollar's share in global reserves fell 10 times faster last year than over the past two decades. The process has accelerated after other countries saw Russia's U.S. dollar and euro-dominated assets frozen abroad and Moscow cut off from the SWIFT global financial messaging system. Iran's top diplomat Bagheri-Kani said, "Activities in this field of work of BRICS have already started, and we hope to strengthen and expand these activities in order to achieve this goal as soon as possible. Russia's RIA Novosti news agency has also covered the same story. The Russian ambassador to Qatar, Dmitry Dugatkin, has said the two countries are seeking to use national currencies in their bilateral trade amid an accelerating wave of de-dollarization across the world. In a recent interview with the Russian news agency, the RIA Novosti, Dmitry Dugatkin, Russia's ambassador to Qatar, said, "The work is underway to diversify away from the US greenback." He said Russia has proposed to diversify mutual trade with Qatar and switch to the use of national currencies. Work in this direction is being carried out between our relevant departments. For decades, the US dollar has been the dominant currency in the global financial system. However, in recent years, a de-dollarization trend has gained momentum as countries try to reduce their exposure to the risks and fluctuations associated with the American currency. In June, during a meeting between Russia's Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin and Qatar's Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, discussions were made about the ruble and the rial in payments. The Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin said at the time that the switch to local currencies is meant to stimulate the launch of a new joint project more actively. He added, "Amid a difficult global economic situation, mutual trade in January to April reached over 1.5 billion rubles, or almost 70 million Qatari rials." Mishustin said, "Russia and Qatar have established a long-term strategic partnership in the energy sector. Qatar Investment Authority is the largest stakeholder of the Russian energy company Rosneft." In mid-July, India and Indonesia agreed to use their local currencies in bilateral trade. According to the Central Bank of India, the announcement came some days after India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit to the United Arab Emirates, where the two countries signed a memorandum of understanding to establish a framework for the use of local currencies for transactions between India and the United Arab Emirates. In February, the Central Bank of Iraq, a major oil supplier, announced that it would allow trade with China to be settled in Chinese yuan for the first time.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939
When he began his Hausa studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. Ashraf Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about khums based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, what's the procedure for calculating the khums on household items?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, first of all, we need to understand that khums means one-fifth of one's yearly earning or the profit one makes and which exceeds the annual expenses of oneself and his family. Now, khums is divided into two portions. One portion is called Sahmi Sadat, and the other portion is called Sahmi Imam. So there are two portions which are equal in terms of the size and value. And of course, the portion which belongs to the Sadat goes to them. It's given to the poor Sayyids and poor people who are from the descendants of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. Of course, they are either poor or they are stranded without money, for example. So that portion is given to them. And then the other portion belongs to the Imams, and peace be upon him. And this time around, of course, it is a qualified jurist who receives that portion and who actually has discretion over that portion. He uses in accordance with the needs and of course, and in its appropriate places. Like, for example, in this time around, the portion which belongs to him to the Imams, of course, is used on the needs of the Islamic seminaries. That is a very quick answer to the question. But when it comes to the items, because we are going to speak about the items, some items are used up very quickly. For example, you buy a piece of bread and you eat it. There's nothing left. But there are some items which endure. like, for example, carpets. Mm-hmm. Now, carpets, you know, take at least 30 years to get worn out. There's no doubt that Khums is not paid on those items which endure and which are not, which are, which remain and which are used. Mm. Now, if you use an item for a short period of time, there's no Khums payable on it, even if many years run over that item. Mm. But things which are in surplus to your yearly income or yearly needs, like, for example, you have goods such as rice, oil, you see, kitchen utensils, which remain unused. Now, there you have you bought, for example, 3 bags of rice or 3 bags of wheat, and then at the end of the year, khums year, I mean, and one bag was left and it's still there. So khums should be paid at the end of the khums year on that bag of rice. And of course, there are a lot of examples to give. For example, there is a bride, for example, who has items gifted to her, and that item remains in her safe in her box, for example, for 1 year or 2 years, and she does not happen to use them at all. Mm-hmm. So obviously she has to pay khums if she herself bought it. But you know, we do know that there are different opinions with regards to the gifts she receives from her relatives.
Right.
Khums is not payable on the gifts, on the gifts given to her by her husband, by her in-laws, or by her parents, okay? According to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, when it comes to, for example, other scholars, there are some scholars who are of the view, like Grand Ayatollah Sistani, who is of the view that khums should be paid on gifts. Mm-hmm. Okay, now,
what about dowry?
Dowry, khums is not payable on on dowry. Yes. Now, when it comes to, for example, let's say, like, give the example of a handkerchief. It remains in the bride's house for a year. It was a handkerchief bought by the bride or maybe by the husband. So it belongs to either the husband or the bride.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's not used for many months or years. Okay. Khums should be paid by her at the end of the khums year.
Isn't it considered a gift?
No, it is. If you know, it belongs either to the man or to his wife. If it belongs to the wife, then she will have to give khums if it belongs to the husband.
But if it is bought, for example, by the husband for his
wife. Yes, in that case, khums is not paid because it's a gift. It came to her as a gift by...
Even if they don't intend it as a gift, like they buy it normally in their house.
Okay, it's not a gift then.
Still
it's,
a
not
gift?
It's not a gift. It's I think it's a property belonging to the family.
Mm-hmm.
It's the father of the family,
right?
Or the person who is in charge of the family, who should pay khums, okay, on behalf of even the other members of the family.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad Hussain, this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic we are, touching on is some of the jurisprudential laws regarding khums based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, someone does not have his own house to live in. He bought a piece of land with the intention of building a house for himself on it. But did not have sufficient funds to build it. A year has passed, and it has been sold, not been sold. Is it liable to Homs? If it is, should he pay Homs on its purchase cost or on its present value?
Okay, good. Well, if he bought the land from the annual earnings of the year in order to build his needed house, I mean, his badly needed house, he's not liable to pay its homes. Oh, because we did state clearly in the previous episode that homes is one of the basic necessities of life. A house is one of the basic necessities of life, so one has to pay. One has to have a house in order to live a decent life, a life that is worth one's dignity and status. So obviously, Homs is not paid on the house that you buy. Even the land that is supposed to be used to buy to build a house, and the money that goes towards buying a house is not liable to Homs. So even in this very scenario that you mentioned, that okay, the piece of land is sold, it's not liable to Homs.
Liable to Homs. I see. In the assumption of the preceding question, if he starts the construction, but it is not completed until the end of his Homs year, is the money spent on the building materials liable to Homs?
Okay, now, I think the scenario is very clear, and this happens to many people, of course. So,
yes. You
know, as you rightly mentioned, there are people who do not have the money or to buy a house, and they save money over the year to, for example, to first of all buy a piece of land and then buy the construction material, and this happens by and by. It's slowly and steadily. You find the money and you build the house. So the answer is very clear based on the explanations we gave earlier, that Homs is not liable. Homs is not paid, actually, on the money that is saved up for this purpose and the money that goes to buy, first of all, the land and then the building materials such as bricks, such as, for example, cement or anything like that.
Even if those building materials or construction materials are not used for the period of 1 year?
Yeah, of course, because they will be used. Okay, sooner or later they will be used to build the house, so Homs is not paid on the material.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We bid you farewell, and until we see you again, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.